fun got in your way, but it didn't stop you. The time change got in your way, but it didn't stop you. And there's other things out there that seemingly want to stop you. But you're here, and it's good to have you here this morning. I imagine that some of you are tired. Some of you probably don't even know that you lost an hour's sleep because your phone just did it for you. And it's now you're going, oh, that's why I'm feeling so sleepy this morning. My name is Trevor. I'm one of the pastors here. If you have a Bible, I would invite you to open up to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. We have, as a church, been walking verse by verse through the book of 1 Corinthians. Where are we in? This is like maybe week 7 out of 10, I think, is where we're at. And in this season, as we kind of march towards Easter, and we're in the Lenten season, which is beautiful. But we have been going through the book of 1 Corinthians, and we're in a section about liberty, which just means freedom and Christian freedom, Christian liberty. What can Christians do? How are we to live? And 2 weeks ago, we talked about giving up these kind of easy things that we could kind of easily give up for love of our neighbor. And then last week, we talked about what it looks like to give up even our essential rights for our neighbor. And so this is a letter that the Apostle Paul wrote a long time ago to a church in Corinth that is very much like the church in our culture today. And so if you've got a Bible, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, we're going to pick up at verse 19, and we're going to read through the end of that chapter. It is behind me on the screen as well. This is 1 Corinthians 9, starting at verse 19. Though I am free and belong to no one, I've made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I'm not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like someone running aimlessly. I do not fight like a boxer beating the air. No, I strike a blow to my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. I was raised in an evangelical church. Again, that big word, evangelical, good news church. A church that believed that we were to be evangelistic. A church that believed that one of the central ideas of being a Christian is that we are to share our faith and to proclaim it to others. And if you are in a church, if you grew up in the evangelical tradition, right, that really believes in like sharing your faith, this passage is like rocket fuel to that movement, right? This passage is very, very familiar. And so we read in this text that Paul has this desire, that he has experienced this good news, right? What Christians call the good news, right? The what God has done for us in Jesus. He's experienced it. He knows that it's true, and he wants everyone to hear about it. And so I was raised in a church where that was just kind of the normal, natural disposition. Like, we want to share this with the world, and we talked about how to do that effectively. And while that was like 20 years ago for me, things have changed significantly in the world. We live in a different world than we did even 20 years ago. If you read the book of Acts, which is this book that talks about the movement of God through his people, the church, and the growth of the church, you'll notice that in that book, God's people kind of move all throughout, right, these different sort of regions, reaching different cultures with the gospel. And here's what's fascinating. Every culture in the book of Acts, right, that the disciples and the apostles reach, every culture that they reach believes these three things. They believe that God exists. They believe that history has something to teach us. And they believe that moral values and duties are objective. Almost everybody that you will want to reach with the gospel, everybody in our culture, does not believe those three things. They don't believe God exists. They don't believe that history is really meaningful and useful, right? Everything in the past is bad. Everything in the future is good. And they don't really believe in moral values and duties as being objective. And so if we're going to share our faith in this city, in this time and place, we have to think about how to do that effectively. When I grew up, it was just like sharing your faith was normal, right? Evangelization was normal. And today, according to Barna, almost 50%, 50% of millennials believe, Christian millennials believe that sharing your faith is wrong, that proselytizing is wrong. And that just seems so wild. But I talk with you and we have conversations and the pressure is real because we definitely live in a culture that has moved from an attempt to persuade others to a kind of whatever you believe is fine and whatever I believe is fine and you believe that, that's your truth, this is my truth. We use language about truth as though it is just very personal and private and very subjective and not objective. And so when we read a text like this and Paul says, I want to win people, some of us go like, oh, I'm not sure I feel about that, right? It feels a little bit like coercion. Is that what we're about? Like Christians, their job is to coerce the world? Is it sort of imperialistic? Like to sort of conquer those who don't believe? Is that kind of our posture? Because that's how some think of it. I remember when I was a student, like I remember going to youth rallies where all the language and imagery was that of like the battlefield. Right? And we have to conquer those who are non-Christians. And yet when you read a text like this, Paul, he kind of argues that Christian witness, it's not about coercion, it's about persuasion. It's not about cultural imperialism, it's about cultural immersion. And so I hope that you are here this morning, and I hope that if you're Christian, you're the kind of Christian that wants to share your faith. But if we're going to do that, we have to know how to do that well. And so this passage today talks about how do we do that well. So here's the three things I want to look at this morning, just really quickly. It's going to be evangelistic agility. I'm going to argue that we need a kind of evangelistic agility. And then I'm going to argue that we need an evangelistic discipline. And then I'll talk and I'll end with an evangelistic focus. Again, evangelistic, the sharing of the good news, the proclaiming of the good news. So let's start here with this first, which is evangelistic agility. In the first verses 19 through 23, Paul's dealing with two groups of people, those who are Jews, that he also refers to as those under the law, and Gentiles, who in Corinth are mostly Greeks, and he calls those people those who are outside of the law. And they're very different groups. The Jews and the Gentiles have different hopes, different goals, different dreams, different aspirations. They have different questions. They have different objections to the same gospel, the same good news. They push it back against it in different ways. And Paul makes it his goal to try to understand them, to immerse himself in their world and in their lives, because he wants to see things the way they see it from the inside. He didn't just want to understand them. He says, I became like them. I became them in order to understand them. I became, as he said, all things to all people. Now, if we're going to go out into the world and we're going to try to reach, persuade, understand, listen to our culture, we have to understand that, like, our culture is not monolithic. People have different views out there, and it's going to take agility for us to be able to be evangelistic. And so let me ask a question that might sort of cause some thoughts for you. This is the first question I would ask is, do you know the hopes and the aspirations or the objections to Christian faith that your neighbors have? Do you know them? Do you feel like you could say, yeah, I mean, I know why my neighbor, my coworker, I know why they're not Christian. I know what objections they have to the Christian faith. I understand their objections. Would you say, I know what they're hopeful for. I know what they're working towards. I know what they desire to be. I know what they're aspiring towards. Can you speak back to them in ways that they would understand? See, the problem is for many of us in the church, we can become so detached and isolated, right, that we can struggle to articulate Christian faith without grabbing onto words that just don't make any sense to our culture anymore, right? You're in a conversation with someone and they go just like, I don't believe the Bible at all. And you go, but the Bible is inerrant. And they go, what does that mean? Right? And then you want to talk about justification and sanctification and glorification. And they're like, what do those words even mean? Right? Like, no one speaks this language anymore. There was a time when the Bible's language was so saturated in our culture that you could speak about it with great confidence and people would know what you're talking about. Today, biblical literacy in our country is at an all-time low. We just don't speak the same language anymore. One of my favorite missionaries is a guy named Leslie Newbegin. And Leslie Newbegin was a British missionary and theologian. And he left the church in England, and he went to India for 40 years. And he preached the gospel, and he was doing missionary work in India. And when he left Britain, it was a very Christian sort of country, and it was a very one kind of country. He went to India, and he had to learn, how am I going to reach these people who just, we don't speak the same language? So he does this amazing job of reaching out and living out faithfully the gospel in India. 40 years later, he comes back to Britain, and his commentary is, when he comes back to Britain, they have become harder to reach than the Indian people that he was just reaching. He like comes home and he goes, everything has changed in 40 years. All the questions that people are asking have changed. All their objections have changed. Their hopes have changed. Their vocabulary has changed. And he said that what Britain was struggling with at the time was something that he called the myth of progress. He showed up in Britain. He started saying, here's what's happening. He started saying, Britain is beginning to believe that the world is moving forward on an evolutionary trajectory towards greater and greater heights of human knowledge and moral behavior. So then he believed that what the church was sort of responding to or not responding to was that the culture was saying, Christians, you've got these silly superstitions, these miracle things you believe in, you should just abandon those. And you've got these old-fashioned rules. Those rules are so old-fashioned, you should get rid of those. Silly superstitions and old-fashioned rules. Does that feel familiar at all? Do you feel that? That the critique that we experience is very similar. You're a Christian? You believe in that? Oh, we don't believe in miracles. Yeah, that's so silly. All those old ways of living, that's so silly. And so Newbegin shows up, and he begins to say to the church in Britain that the church needed a missionary encounter with its own culture. Look, we as a church say that we exist to help people know Jesus, to grow in faith, and go into the world equipped to serve. The world starts on the other side of those doors. The world is not only in some far-off place. Our world still needs to be reached with the gospel. Our culture still needs to be reached. Amen? The ground has shifted in our own culture, and we cannot afford to isolate ourselves. I mean, people just don't know what we're talking about anymore. Christian ease is perceived as a primal, simplistic grunting. It's like we're grunting in the world. People just have no idea what we're talking about. And so we have to make adjustments. We have to learn the hopes, the questions, and the language of our culture. We need a kind of evangelistic agility. But let me be clear. Evangelistic agility does not require assimilation. When I say we need evangelistic agility, I don't mean that we adapt to the culture or adopt the culture. We adapt, but we don't adopt. I don't mean that we blindly follow or become enculturated. Paul would have never said, to the thieves, I become as a thief. To the adulterers, I become as an adulterer. He would never have said that kind of thing. He's all about contextualization, seeing the world the way that these cultures see the world, becoming as a Jew, as a Greek, as the weak, in order that he might be more critical of its flaws and failures. It is easier to critique a culture when you understand a culture. No one cares what you think if you're not actually connected to the very culture that you're loving and trying to serve and trying to be critical of. Paul does this with the Jews. He sees himself as a Jew of Jews. He understood the law thoroughly, and his frustration after just being so thoroughly Jewish was to look around at the landscape of all that they believed about the law, and his concern is that his Jewish people had become so occupied with the letter of the law, they forgot what the law was about. They forgot its spirit. The law, why does God give us all these rules? The simple answer, that we would love God and love our neighbor. And they'd forgotten that. They'd forgotten that the law was about love of God and love of neighbor. Instead, the law for the Jews had become about strict adherence to the rules above all else. And that created division and hostility between those who kept it and those who didn't. And that was not its point. God did not give the law to create hostility. He created the law so that we might know what it looks like to love God and love others. Do you recognize that when God gives a commandment, the heart of that commandment is not merely moral obedience, it's that we would love God and love our neighbors more effectively. And so Paul argues that the Jews had adopted a law without love. A law without love. Any of you ever been a part of a Christian community that believed in law without love? It was all these rules, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. And you're like, what's the point? And it seemed like the point was just to follow the rules. It became just like a rule book. We're in the Lenten season. And in the Lent season, it's common and historically traditional for people to fast, right? God does not require that we fast during Lent, but it's a very beneficial thing. God does require that we fast, but not like specifically during the Lent season. And so my son, Moses, he decided that he made the decision. I said, you don't have to fast during Lent, like, but it can be really good. And he decided, I'm going to. So he gave up dessert, which was awesome. He's like 11. He's like, I'm going to give up desserts, right? He never really done this thing before. He gets like 3 days in, and he is like regretting it so much. 11 years old, and he just realized that most of his world consists of pizza and dessert. Like everywhere he goes, it's like, oh, kids are here. Here's more pizza and more dessert. So he's like 3 days in, and he's with my wife, and he turns to her because she's getting like these smoothies. And he says, Mom, can I have a smoothie? And she's like, why are you asking me if you can have a smoothie? Like, you can have a smoothie. And he goes, I'm just not sure that I can do that or if it qualifies as dessert. And she's like, you made this rule up. Like, this is like God, this is you. This is like, do you see how quickly his heart went so quickly from, I made this rule, and then instantly I'm going to start looking for ways to like perfectly follow it. He missed that like the point of fasting is that we would rely on God more, not that we would obsess over whether smoothies qualify as desserts. And that's what our hearts do. We get so preoccupied with the rule and the law that we forget that the point of it is love. The point of God's law is that we would love God and love our neighbors. That's the point. That's why God gives them. And so Paul's frustration is that to the Jews, it had become a law without love. But the Greeks had done the exact opposite. They were practicing love without law. They were saying, love is love is love is love. No rules, no boundaries, nothing. Just love. And to which Paul would say, and I would wholeheartedly agree with him, if you say love and there are no rules and boundaries, it's not love. If you say to your child, I love you, you can do whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want. You don't love your child. You don't. It's a facade. You call it love, And it kind of looks like it from the outside, but buried beneath it is the recognition that you, if you don't have any rules, you can't have any justice. And what is love without justice? It's a foolish thing to tell a child, I love you so much, there are no rules and boundaries. If you tell your child that, you're setting them up to be harmed so greatly under the auspices of love. It's not love. And so Paul's concern is that the Greeks had become all about love, and they called it love, but there weren't any sort of laws. There were no borders around it. And so Paul says, I'm not going to be under the law like the Jews. I reject the law without love, right? I'm not going to be outside of the law like the Greeks. I reject love without law. Instead, he argues for this third way, a law of love. A law of love. Freedom, he argues for. Freedom, but freedom for the good of others. And let me be clear, that will take great agility. Evangelistic agility. Secondly, evangelistic discipline. Verses 24 through 27, this robust text that some of you who are raised in the church know extremely well, which we always talk about as a text that's about the importance of discipline in the Christian life. But Paul's point is not the importance of discipline in the Christian life. Placed in the book of 1 Corinthians, it's clear that Paul's point is about proclamation of the gospel. He's disciplining himself so he can proclaim the gospel more effectively, so that he can be a witness. It is so tempting to isolate ourselves from the culture. That is your challenge, is that you will often either lean into isolating from our culture or assimilating to our culture. Paul calls for this third way. Christ calls for this third way. I'm calling for this third way. That we would be people who would not retreat, but we would do the dirty work of getting to know and love and serve our actual neighbors. It takes work to know them, their hopes and aspirations, their objections, their issues. And it's hard to do when we don't even share the same assumptions anymore. The same language. We use a word like success in the church, and it means something very different than it does outside. We use the word sex, and it means something very different inside the church than outside. The word justice is different. The word love is different. And it takes work and training and discipline in order to remain faithful and steadfast in the culture if we're going to love and serve it well. You cannot be an effective witness without a tremendous amount of effort. Today, the LA Marathon is happening. I was asked this question a few minutes ago, which is, I don't think you can walk the LA Marathon. Like, I don't think if you start it and you walk, it's 26 miles? I don't think you finish. I think everyone's gone home by the time you finish. I don't think walking it's an option. So you got to maintain a certain pace. I'm not sure what that is. But, like, the people who finish first do it in, 2 hours. Or just under 3 hours. It's insanity how the people who win these races, they train so hard for this LA Marathon. And nobody knows who most of these people are. You may read tomorrow in the paper or later today, you might see on social media who won the LA Marathon. And you'll be like, oh, what a nice achievement. And then you'll move on and forget their name within a week and you won't really ever hear about them again. Same thing with the Olympics, right? I love the Olympics. Happens every 4 years. May or may not happen this year. But I love the Olympics, especially the Summer Olympics, not so much the winter ones. I mean, it's because we don't go around snow, but I've also never done much gymnastics, so I'm not sure the difference between why I like the summer more than the winter. But the Summer Olympics may or may not happen this year. And you know what I love about the Olympics is there's all these sports that I've never heard of that people spend 4 years of their life training day in and day out for this one shining moment when the world kind of looks in and goes like, wow, that's a cool way of swimming. And that's kind of like, that's it. They do it. They win a medal, and you're like, that was wonderful. They work so hard for this moment. There's a training and a discipline to it that Paul applies to himself. He says that he's going to train and he's going to discipline himself, right, for the preaching of the gospel. And it's going to take discipline and training for us to do that effectively. We live in this world today where people, the air we breathe as a society is still Christian, but many people have tossed off Christian framing while holding on to the assets it's given them that they've liked. So that's kind of the world we live in, right? So Christian framing gave the world science. But most people today who love science are like, I don't need Christian faith to be a good scientist, right? I don't need Christian faith to have morals. I don't need Christian faith to have justice. I don't need it to discover that love is supreme. I don't need it for virtue, right? So they've grabbed all these gifts that Christian faith has given them, and then they've tossed Christian faith in the trash can. And when Nietzsche taught and said that God is dead, his fundamental idea was that we had thrown God out while attempting to hold on to all of these assets that God has given us. And as a result, we see all these people who adhere to very Christian things, things they got from Christian faith, while simultaneously rejecting Christianity. I was listening to a Christian and non-Christian talk. And the non-Christian was saying, I now, with science and technology, I can create like God. If you give me some dirt, I can make life from it. And the Christian responded, who says that you get to start with dirt? If you're going to create like God, you have to start with nothing. And it was sort of pointing out this point of like, well, I can take the things that I've been given and then I can work with the dirt. No, when God creates from nothing. Our culture has thrown off Christian faith, holding on to the gifts of Christian faith. And our culture no longer sees Christian faith as intellectually credible. So when we say, hey, we got to go preach the gospel and share the gospel, that's true. But we have to learn to share the gospel while also showing that Christianity is plausible and intellectually credible. Today, our culture will not take Christian faith seriously until we address some of the questions they have. Every year as I preach, I realize I'm getting older. And one of the ways I know I'm getting older is I start thinking those things that I heard my grandparents say, which like the kids these days, right? But like, this week, I'm going to say this sentence. I can't believe I'm going to say this. This week, I read a story about two YouTubers. That's not a sentence I don't think I'd be familiar with a few years ago. But there are these two YouTubers who are, I guess, relatively famous amongst people much younger than myself. Their names are Rhett and Link, and they host a show that's widely consumed by people who are sort of high school and middle school. And they both were Campus Crusade. They both were Christian missionaries who have now gone through a public deconversion, where they are now both proclaiming, like, we don't believe in God anymore, and we are not Christian anymore. And I was listening to them articulate why they have abandoned their Christian faith. They've got millions of people who watch them and consume their content, and they have now said, we're not Christians anymore. And you listen to them talk, and they talk about how they couldn't reconcile Christian faith and science. They couldn't reconcile a loving God with pain and suffering and hell. They couldn't reconcile Christian faith with its exclusive claims in the world. They couldn't, what do you mean Christianity? Jesus is the only way. Like, they couldn't reconcile that. And people in our world have questions. People want to know, does Christian faith make a difference at all? What impact does it have on a society, politics, economics, the public square? So a question for you is, are you growing in your ability to answer your neighbor's questions? Do you feel like you're more equipped to answer your neighbor's questions and objections today? I mean, I hope you do. If not, it takes agility, but it also takes discipline. We need to address our culture's questions winsomely and apologetically in order for people to take our message seriously. First Peter says, always be prepared to give an answer for the hope that is within you, and do so with gentleness and respect. If we don't learn how to do this well, we, like Paul, will be running aimlessly, beating the air. I don't do this very often, but I have lots of sort of resources in this area. I want to recommend these two books Just because some of you might be like, you know what, I do need to learn more. I do need to understand more. I want to understand my culture better, and I want to understand my faith better and how those intersect so that I can love my neighbor. On the book on the left is a book by Timothy Keller called The Reason for God. If you've never read that book, it's great. It's like maybe 10 years old, I think, now. It's really, truly fantastic. I think everyone should read it. And the book on the right came out last year, and it was my favorite book I think I read last year, especially in this area. It's Confronting Christianity, written by Rebecca McLaughlin, 12 Hard Questions for the World's Largest Religion, where she just kind of says, these are the questions people are asking, really asking, and here's how I would respond to those. And both those books are really worth your time, especially if you want to get good at this. And I've got a copy of both of those books, and if you want to borrow mine, come up to me after the service and just say, can I borrow your copy? And I'd love to let you borrow my copy. But both those books I would highly recommend to you. Look, it's hard. And we live in an age where you've got a lot of choices. We live in an age of pleasure, entertainment, leisure. You compete. Every day your time is sort of asked for by television, sports, video games, social media. And you can say, like, look, I'm going to just ignore this. I don't really care what questions my neighbors are asking. I don't want to do that. Like, an athlete doesn't have to train. Like, they can sleep in and eat cake. They can do that instead. But they don't because they see that there's something worth it. There's something worth it. We can keep on keeping on. We can ignore our culture, or we can give up some of our freedom to love our neighbors better. And I would argue that if our attitude is, I'm unwilling to discipline myself, I would argue that something has gone wrong. The word Paul uses in verse 27, disqualified, is a word that means counterfeit. And Paul's arguing, I don't want to have counterfeit love for my neighbors. I don't want to have counterfeit love for my city. And so we need discipline. Lastly, and quickly, we need evangelistic focus. Paul says several times he's trying to win people, to save people. And that can read really quickly like dominance. I would remind you that as Christians, we are always trying to win people more than we are trying to win arguments. Jesus wins us by dying, not by conquering. He wins us the same. If you look at verse 23, Paul says, I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. The Greek construction of this is actually, I do all things for the sake of the gospel so that I may become a fellow partaker of its nature. Paul's not in it for rewards. He's in this work because he wants to share in the gospel with others. He wants to share in the gospel with others. When you see someone who goes from death to life, deadness to aliveness, guilt to freedom, shame to relief, right? Darkness to light, from blindness to clarity. I mean, it is this amazingly beautiful thing that you get to celebrate in together. The gospel that Paul's talking about is fundamentally about how God became one of us. He knows our deepest needs. He knows our aspirations, our hopes, our struggles. He knows your questions. He knows your objections. And he immersed himself in our world, speaking, loving, serving, and sharing, and then giving his life away for us and for our sin. He gave it up. Christ loses it all because he's so focused on you and on me. And so when we see Jesus' focus for what he was doing for sinners like us, it gives us focus, not just to share the gospel with others, but to long to share in its nature when we do that. Why do Christians listen, think, talk? Why do we endure being called bigoted, being mistreated, being mocked? Why will we work towards being agile, understanding, and listening? Why will we speak and train and discipline ourselves to love our neighbors when it gets hard? We'll do it to share in what God has done for us and to share in how he did it for us. So I'll end with this question, because it's the most important question. If you don't get this right, it's hard to get any of it right. Are you captivated by the beauty of the gospel? You will never share your faith effectively until you have first been won over. And I don't just mean that you're like interested. I mean that when you allow it to shape your loves and your hopes and your aspirations and your desires, when you're so enamored with it, it moves you so deeply, you will so desperately want other people to experience in it with you. Our focus is not winning souls or arguments, winning converts or rewards or becoming more knowledgeable. Our focus is standing next to our neighbors and our family members and our friends and sharing with them in the gospel that has saved us. And as we do that, we learn to show it more and more through our words and through our love. We do it all for the sake of the gospel, that we may share with them in it. We need, church, if we are going to be God's people faithfully in this culture, to have an evangelistic agility, a discipline, and a focus. And if we get that right, I believe that God can use us to do some pretty beautiful things in the places that He has already called us.